Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting and by Smallville, the complete fifth season available on DVD now. Own the season when the Fortress of Solitude rises and Clark is forced to accept his destiny.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Holgren. Coming up on this week's show, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, new music from Dan Byrne, and we kick off our six-week documentary marathon with D.A. Pennybaker's Don't Look Back.
Plus, this week's top five movies about Hollywood. But first, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's the mysterious death of George Reeves. Our review of Ben Affleck, Adrian Brody, and Diane Lane in Hollywoodland.
The guy used to play Superman. He shot himself. What?
Someone thinks he didn't.
Mr. Reeves? Why don't you tell me about him?
A charming man.
I'm much too old for you, you know?
Your husband is the general manager of MGM.
Tell me what you want. You can have it.
Where he wound up?
It should have been enough.
What are these? These marks. What did he do, beat himself up before he shot himself?
Dead detective. What's he got?
Some questions.
Since when do suicides miss twice and start over?
It's hard to watch Alan Coulter's Hollywoodland and not think of Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard. Especially if you're like me, you watched Sunset Boulevard for the first time a couple of hours after watching Coulter's film. Both take place in Hollywood's high glamour period in the mid-20th century, and both start with the mysterious death of a small-time Hollywood player. Hollywoodland adds another familiar L.A. County movie character to the mix, the down-on-his-luck private eye who gets involved in a case that's much more complicated than at first meets the eye. Yes, if it were a pitch to a Hollywood executive, it's Sunset Boulevard meets Chinatown. The tragic figure in Hollywoodland is TV's first Superman, George Reeves, Ben Affleck, who died under mysterious circumstances in June of 1959, ruled a suicide at the time the movie, through the eyes of private eye Louis Simo, Adrian Brody, investigates the sad circumstances and sad characters that surrounded Reeves' last days. A flamboyant, tough-talking fiancé, played by Robin Tunney, a heartbroken ex-mistress, played by Diane Lane, and Lane's above-the-law studio executive husband, played by Bob Hoskins. Adam, as I'm sure we'll discuss later in the show with our top five movies about Hollywood, there have been no shortage of films exploring the sad contradiction that exists in Hollywood between glamour, wealth, and power, and the desperate and sometimes depraved desire for those very things. Does Hollywoodland achieve the power of any of these previous films, like Wilder, Sunset Boulevard, or one of your personal favorites, Polanski's Chinatown?
Well, you're absolutely right, of course, with our top five. I was putting my list together. I'll already say it. Sunset Boulevard is on the list, and I made in my notes that it's a great tie-in with this film, Hollywoodland, because you do, beyond the connections you mentioned, you've got Joe Gillis as kind of the kept man to Norma Desmond, who provides him with money and a place to live and, you know, kind of his sugar mama or whatever. I don't know what they called it back then. Maybe kept man is that word I kept seeing. But here you've got that same thing where George Reeves, Ben Affleck, he's under the thumb of Diane Lane, and she buys him a house and all the things that he needs to survive. And of course, like Chinatown, Louis Simo is that Jake Gittes character. He's the anti-hero private detective. There's even a nice similarity where, you know, in Chinatown, Jake Gittes gets his nose slit by Roman Polanski and spends the rest of the film bandaged. And here, you know, he gets, Louis Simo gets nailed with a chain right to the
face.
Slightly
more brutal,
Yeah, it is more brutal. It's really hard to watch, actually. And he spends the rest of the film with his face all beat up. So those connections are there. And the movie does feel like Chinatown to me. And the way it draws you into its mystery, but if you're asking if it compares in any way to those two
maybe
films,
that was an unfair question.
To those two classics, no, it doesn't. And the big reason for me why it doesn't match up to a film like Chinatown, a film I love, is that rather than let the big, dramatic, existential questions come out of the story, come out of the mystery the way Roman Polanski and Robert Towne do in Chinatown, you know, following Gittes through this case, trying to make sense of all the clues, Alan Coulter here, the director, a first-time director, he wants to have all those big existential questions out front and center and pushes the mystery to the side, which ultimately isn't as satisfying for me. He really wants to make this movie a redemption story, which in some ways Chinatown is even too, though by the end it's much bleaker, but he wants us to see how Adrian Brody's character, Louis Simo, is redeemed in some way, becomes a man of conscience, and he's a good father by the end, or we think he's going to be a good father, all because of working on this case and somehow these parallels between his own life and what he sees in George Reeves. He sees something in investigating George Reeves in his own life. And that whole attempt, really, on Coulter's part seemed really contrived for me and didn't work for me. That said, I didn't really dislike the movie and, in fact, could recommend it to people based on one thing, and it's the most cliched reason a film critic can give, but it's the performances. And before I talk about those, I'm going to go ahead and let you jump in.
Yeah, no, I think I saw the same things. I think if you look at this story, as clearly the screenwriter did and Coulter did as director, you know, you look at just the story of the mysterious death of George Reeves, and you just see all of these huge themes jump out at you. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they just it must be like moss to a flame if the flame is a screenwriter, and he's looking at this thing, and he's like, oh my gosh, I mean, you've got just the death of this small-town player and the sort of depraved underbelly of glamour in Hollywood, mm-hmm. but also the murder, the character he's tied to, Superman, loss of innocence in the mid-50s of America. And it's just, I just felt like the weight of everything he wanted to do, particularly, I really looked at the script itself, and it seems really, really ambitious, and I admire the way he drew a lot of parallels between George Reeves and Adrian Brody's characters, a lot of interesting things there, so much he wants to do that I was never really drawn in. I was distracted. I felt mm-hmm. like he got distracted, and you brought up the whole mystery of it, and I think unfairly, I had an unfair criticism, I realized, because the movie is being marketed as the unexplained death of George Reeves.
Right.
And at the end of the film, of course, there is the lack of satisfaction you get because the mystery is not solved.
Right.
And it never was going to be, I suppose. But I don't know if I just missed that in the previews. But nowhere in the film are we told that it's unexplained. I mean, as I recall, I don't think at the beginning of the film you know that this...
No, it's labeled a suicide.
It's labeled a suicide, yeah, as it is on
it
IMDb.
It seems open and
shut. George Reeves. Yeah, it seems... Right, but I think the various things that that Simo imagines, the scenarios mm-hmm. that could have happened, you know, is it the movie boss, or is it suicide, or is it his sort of flaky fiance?
Right.
And all of them are really compelling. I found his imaginings of those scenarios interesting, mm-hmm. but also unsatisfying as far as this mystery goes. And again, this movie is trying to do a number of things. I think it is this examination of Hollywood and of America and of this man and his place in it. But the mystery side of things is kind of... It left me with a kind of deep dissatisfaction by the end, because I ultimately, just his curiosity about what may have happened wasn't quite enough.
No, I agree with you that I felt unsatisfied too, but it wasn't because the mystery wasn't ultimately explained. I knew going in that everyone thinks that this George Reeves death is a suicide, but there's a lot of questions about it, and so I didn't really expect the movie to come out with a verdict.
And I didn't need it to. Right.
But I think by the end, just by the fact that they give you the last explanation they do last,
yes,
it is the last one, and it is the one they spend
the
most time
stuck,
with.
Yeah.
It's kind of curiously the conventional wisdom one,
right,
which is kind of interesting. But I did like the way he reimagined those three deaths.
Yeah,
I agree with you that you are wanting to kind of see them reenacted, and the way he reenacts them supports all of the evidence.
Yeah.
You can really believe that it was someone who came in the room and shot him in the back of the head out of vindictiveness. You can believe that it was his fiance who killed him accidentally, perhaps,
yep,
or you can buy that he did kill himself. You can believe all those explanations. And so I did like that. But again, Coulter's too caught up in the whole Simo fallen redemption to really spend enough time with those. And I mean, one of the suggestions, this occurred to me watching it, is that one of them is that Eddie Mannix did it. Bob Hoskins, as this MGM studio head, hires someone to do it because he's apparently upset that his wife is sleeping with George Reeves, but apparently, you know, earlier in the film, we see that's not a big deal with them. They have dinner together.
I think the way he justifies it is Reeves has clearly broken off the relationship. He's upset. He doesn't like to see his wife upset. And he'll do anything to make her feel better, which, again, if you look at it as that kind of justification, that's hard to buy.
Well, honestly, I'll give you an even bigger reason it's hard to buy, and that is that right after, we see this scene, this potential version of events, right after it, we get the scene where Eddie Mannix has George Reeves' career ruined. He makes a phone call and has him, he's supposed to be directing a picture, he has it shut down.
Right.
He makes a few calls and he has it shut down. And so here's a case where the filmmaker is at once trying to make us buy for a second that maybe he was so angered about his wife and this affair and how it ended that he wanted him dead, when in fact we see how it really works in Hollywood. He ended his career. He committed murder, essentially, by killing his career. He didn't really need, of course, to actually kill the guy, and I didn't buy for a second that really that could have happened. I mean, the way it happens, yes, but the reasons behind it, the motive, I didn't really buy there at all. And I thought the movie undermined that, and I think that, you know, again, undermining its own movie, Coulter is undermining himself, because Simo seems at first like a good detective, if not a great detective, at least a good one.
Right.
Got a good head on his shoulders.
Yeah,
he's dogged. He's really going to pursue this. But he seems to follow whatever evidence Coulter wants to put in front of him at any given time to follow a certain storyline. And he doesn't piece anything together. He doesn't really do any extra thinking.
Well, I guess that's it. There's no satisfaction in him getting to the bottom of anything. He imagines something, a possible scenario, and then moves on to the next one.
And moves on to the next one. That's exactly right, which is different than a guy like Jake Gittes, who actually has to do some thinking. We don't. We see the evidence that he sees, but he has to piece some things together and eventually comes up with a new conclusion. And here, he's ready to convict whoever he's supposed to be investigating at the time. He gets a bunch of press clippings that Eddie Mannix, you know, people close to him seem to die in car accidents, and all of a sudden he's at his house calling him a murderer.
Right.
And it's like he never thought when he was investigating this case, and he knows that he's involved tangentially through his wife, he never thought to look at the press clippings. Maybe, you know, I didn't buy that. And then the other thing where the movie fails along this the same line here is that not only does he apparently not think to look at the press clippings until a cop gives them to him, but he doesn't investigate ever the other guy who was there the night he was murdered. He talks to the two women, but not the guy. And at one point, the movie makes you think that he's going to, because it's showing the reenactment, and
then
the movie
focuses to him all of a sudden
on his face for a second, this guy, Bill Bliss, who was there. And since it's a vision kind of in his head of this flashback of what may have happened, you think he's realized something. He's realized that, oh, I got to talk to this guy, and maybe he was involved. That doesn't happen. The movie just moves on. I just never really buy that as a detective, he never goes down the right paths and comes up with interesting information and pieces anything together.
Well, I think ultimately the movie has given up, in a sense, on the mystery before the movie even begins. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's actually interested in being a mystery.
That's what I'm saying.
And so it's totally unsatisfying in that way. And I think that's part of it, too. There are a lot of loose strands in here. The mother character that's introduced that sort of sets the whole investigation in motion. She hires Simo, or Simo gets her to hire him, rather. And there's some interesting information revealed about her role in Reeves' early life in terms of she told him that her father, you know, his father killed himself, and he maybe hadn't. And it's just sort of put out there.
It's tacked on.
And I was thinking, I mean, I imagine that this original script, which I know has been kicking around for a long time, they've been trying to make this film for a long time, would have been an interesting read. There's a lot of interesting psychological insight into characters that's revealed in an interesting way in the dialogue, and I think it would allow you as the reader to project interesting motivations into the characters.
Yeah.
But seeing them on screen, they never come to life.
Right.
None of the motivations come to life. And you're right. It's just, so the mystery isn't compelling. We're not actually seeing him piece anything together. We're not interested. Those reimaginings of the scenarios are interesting in themselves, but also don't lead to anything
else. They don't.
And then I think we need to get to one of the central problems with it is Mr. Affleck as George Reeves. I think in order for this film to work, I think you do need a tragic central figure. I think the screenwriter, the director, see George Reeves. They have to perceive him as a tragic figure in some way because he represents something, a loss of innocence or whatever it is, or this victim of Hollywood. Affleck can't pull it off. He just can't pull it off. I don't have a beef with Affleck. I don't think he's a bad actor. I think he can be really charismatic. He hasn't done a lot recently that's given him a chance to be that way, but that's how I remember him. And I was actually looking forward to him having the chance really to show what skills he has. But here he seems very two-dimensional to me.
Okay.
He didn't have any, you know, I really think I needed to see him, particularly we see him later in the film as, you know, I think about 9 years pass in the course of this entire film. And we have to see him at a very desperate point in his career. He's trying to reignite it. And he's even considering going out on tour as a wrestling.
At the end,
And, you know, there's a sort of sad videotape of him, like, trying to show that he still has some moves. And he doesn't. And there's an opportunity there for that to be really kind of tragic. There are other moments, too. And I just didn't. I really just didn't with Affleck.
Okay. Well, I didn't mind Affleck. And what I was saying about the performance is why, on the whole, I think is the reason to go see this movie, is that he at least, like all of them, and again, I'm not 100% sure. I'm not ready to commit and say all the performances are uniformly good, but they are uniformly interesting, and all at least make big, bold choices, which we talk about sometimes. And Affleck does that. He tries to capture that theatricality and that kind of charm, and also just, you know, again, the kind of gentleman that he was, this old school type of actor.
Sure.
I think he goes out of his way to be a different kind of Ben Affleck.
I agree.
And I give
him
credit for that. I wonder if you'll buy my explanation that it isn't the performance that undercuts that character, that makes him not satisfying in some way, but maybe the film. And here's what I'll say to
you. I already agree.
Here's what it is that occurred to me later. I realized as I was watching the film at some point that I never really cared.
Yeah.
To really even find out how he died, because I didn't care about him much as a character. And I was trying to piece together why, you know, this tragic fall of his own. Why did I not care about the fact that he ends up sad and depressed and, you know, without love and possibly kills himself, or even if he gets murdered, that's bad enough, you know,
right.
That he's sunk to that point. And it hit me that the problem is that the movie is, we see him only in flashbacks. We see him only as an amalgam of situations and moments, and never just as a character, a living, breathing character. We only see what people are kind of piecing together, and he becomes essentially a flashback. The way you remember someone in a memory, you don't ever have any moments of just him being George Reeves.
Right.
And so by the end of it, you feel like he's just, it's a collection of moments that are supposed to define him rather as him being a character. And I wonder, it's interesting that we got an email from one of our listeners, Jim Briggs, who wrote in and said that he read a review of the movie, and he's seen the film, where they said that Adrian Brody's character actually was unnecessary, Adrian Brody as Simo. And it made him think of a top five list, movies with an unnecessary protagonist. Good story, well told, but what the hell is he doing here? And I wonder if maybe...
Guy Pearce in the Proposition in a way.
Maybe, yeah. And I was thinking about it, and I'm conflicted because I haven't even talked about Adrian Brody yet. And
right.
I don't want to take Adrian Brody out of this film because I like him so much, as we'll get to, hopefully. But I thought that was an interesting question, because I wonder if maybe if Coulter had taken out the Simo character and just told the George Reeves story, I think then
and
maybe...
And to make a man of him, a living,
breathing
man
out of him.
I agree.
Then I think maybe Affleck's performance, maybe for you it still would have hurt everything, but I think he would have had more chances and it would have worked better.
You know what's interesting is that I kept thinking, because these are flashbacks, but these are flashbacks to, well, at first, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years before when he's first meeting Diane Lane's character, but a lot of, by the end, I mean, the difference between the flashbacks and the reality where Adrian Brody is like a matter of weeks
right.
or months even, but it always felt to me like I was always surprised to find Brody's character in the 50s with Reeves' character.
Mm-hmm.
I kept thinking that he should be in the 70s or something, looking back on this time like years and years, decades
before. No, but
before.
The information is still fresh.
It has a feel to it, but I think there's almost a different feel to the performance. There's a very mannered performance, theatrical quality to Reeves, to Ben Affleck, and to Diane Lane's performance.
Certainly.
And to me...
And Robin Tunney.
And Robin Tunney. Robin Tunney, who is fantastic,
she
I
is.
Think. She's the standout in this, because I think she seems to get right what the other characters don't quite is, or the other actors don't quite get right, is the fun in the theatrical nature of it. There's a kind of distancing, emotional distancing, that I had with the characters,
I think
you're saying,
fair.
Reeves
yeah.
and Diane Lane, that doesn't allow us to see these people as real, living, breathing people. And that made it really difficult to sort of take on the tragedy.
Yeah, I did find it really funny at one point. I wonder if anyone else had this reaction or thought this was kind of an ironic joke, but there's a moment late in the film where Adrian Brody is sitting talking to Art, I think his name is. And I love that actor, too. He's a That Guy actor who is George Reeves' agent.
Yeah,
and they're just kind of reminiscing about George Reeves, what kind of guy he was. And he says he was a charming guy and a good-looking guy and a good actor. And he says he was not like those actors today who are always squinting and mumbling.
Yeah, that was great.
And I thought it was hilarious because...
James Dean and Marlon Brando.
Well, yeah, but also Adrian Brody.
Oh,
he's sitting right across the table from Adrian Brody, who, if you think about it, really is in many ways a squinter and a mumbler.
Right.
That's the kind of
that's
actor
great,
he is,
yeah,
which is
point.
In sharp contrast to a guy like
a contemporary
George Reeves
actor
and the way Ben Affleck is portraying him and all the other people in the film. And so I thought that was really funny. But with that said, that's not a knock for me at all. I really had a moment where watching this film, I forgot how good Adrian Brody is until I saw this movie. And we have this poll question up on our site. We're going to get the results here in a minute, where we asked about Ed Norton. Is he one of the best actors of his generation, the best actor working today, whatever? And we're going to see the results came out largely. People think he's brilliant. He's certainly one of, if not the. And I was one of those people. But you know what?
You know who's better?
After seeing The Illusionist, which is a film I loved, and after seeing this film, which is a film I did not love, I would still be more interested in seeing Adrian Brody's next film than Ed Norton's next film. He somehow captures being a kind of tough guy detective, while at the same time being someone who seems like a really tragic, defeated soul.
Yeah,
and the wit he brings to many of these scenes, I mean, just his smiles, his reaction, his nonverbal reactions, but then also the way he delivers certain lines.
Yeah, he's got grace. It's a believability. Yeah,
he brings humor and just a bit of cleverness to
which
to
Ed
moments,
Norton does not do.
Which Ed Norton doesn't do, that otherwise wouldn't have him. And really, I would say to people, I would say, you know what, Hollywoodland is worth seeing. I think, even though I don't think it works on the whole, and I don't think his character is maybe even necessary in some way,
but
I love Adrian Brody's performance.
I do too. And if we have a quick second, I just want to say, I think part of the reason, and I think you're right to point out, yes, Ben Affleck's character, George Reeves, does exist as a series of flashbacks, but part two, immediately there's a sadness to him. There's no sense of him like being on the verge of glamour, of discovery.
No.
And I think part of it is the acting. I think part of it is the choices that the director with Affleck makes. But also, I was imagining somebody with a bit more like verbal alacrity, somebody like a Vince Vaughn, who gives off just an energy that Affleck never does. I'm not saying Vince Vaughn would have been better in this role. I'm just saying imagine a character that really is full of energy and joy, or joie de vivre, if you will. And there's a kind of deadness
throughout, early on.
And I think if we had a sense of like what could be, we'd have a better sense of what wasn't or didn't turn out to be.
I mean, I think right from the beginning, though, you have to see that Coulter has given us from the opening scene a guy who is trying too hard. He's pathetic, even if he shouldn't be pathetic, or in some ways isn't. He's a very noble person.
Right.
You have to give him, you know, that and say that he is very noble, but he's also trying too hard and is kind of pathetic at the same time. And the last thing I will say about the film is the one thing I did like about the mom character is, and the way that kind of tacked on thing, is that by the end, that's the one thing that really kind of made everything click, where you do see the Chinatown nature of what's going on, where it's all about what you can get, and it's more about perception than reality, or any, you know, than over anything else. It's about the image is what matters. And by the end, we realize that all she really wanted, she doesn't want justice. She doesn't care.
She wants a statue. She wants people to know
that she gave birth to a star, basically. And I like that touch.
That's the thing. I liked a lot of the extraneous touches. They just didn't add up to
anything, they don't,
unfortunately. All right. Well, if you've seen Hollywood Land and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
After the break, what movie was it that Sam's mom threw into the VCR after frantically ejecting Fast Times at Ridgemont High back in 85-86? The answer next, plus your top five high school movies in listener feedback, but first some recent audio feedback.
Hey guys, this is Jeff in San Diego. Just wanted to drop you a line. I love the show, and I loved last week's show, especially about the top five, the crying movies and stuff. I was wondering, no one mentioned Saving Private Ryan. I don't know if it's just me, but towards the end of the movie, when all of the heroes of the movie seem to just be dropping like flies and dying, and then you know, he says, "Earn this." Tom Hanks says to the other character, Private Ryan, he says, "Earn this." And then you flash forward to when he's an old man, and he's with his kids and his grandkids, and he says, "Have I lived a good life?" That kind of always gets me. The tears start flowing with me on that every scene. And also, one of my favorite movies and moments, I don't know why I tear up as a grown man, Lilo and Stitch. Ohana means family. Makes me cry every time. Love the show. Thanks, you guys.
Now just a couple Snickers and some cornmeal mush. I fed 6,000 at a time. I spoke in St. Louis, you gotta play St. Louis. St. Louis is a ruler of some kind. The blind came to me and I made him see. Got the deaf digging high fidelity card tricks. I could do card tricks you wouldn't believe. There's nothing innocent about a newborn babe that a few years here can't cure. And it's not so much that you burn out, baby, but you finally get a little overwhelmed. Wars and pain and poverty, those have been around a long time. But the oceans rise and the fresh water dies, and the hate sticks harder to your insides. And the cars get bigger and your smoke turns out, and your idols fall and you lie.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, and you're listening to the smooth sounds of Dan Byrne. We just wanted to thank Messenger Records here real quick for sending us the CD.
Yeah, Lotar. So delicious, yeah.
I can see that. New album from Dan comes out, I think, this week, actually, on Messenger Records, his new album, Breathe. And so, again, we just wanted to acknowledge that. Thank Messenger Records. I know I'm looking forward to the album and glad to have it now in my possession. And I know several of our listeners are looking forward to it as well. You'll hear more music from Breathe here throughout the show. Also, we wanted to announce the PureFlix DVD giveaway winner. We don't have the name yet, so we will announce the winner of Brazil, the Criterion Collection, which was just out on DVD last week. We'll announce that winner on the filmspotting.net site in the notes for this show, so look for that. And briefly, I just wanted to mention, from time to time we do this, our trading habits on PeerFlix, and
right.
I've been very active lately on PeerFlix. The last three movies I got, and this is how I've been kind of using PeerFlix, is a way to get movies that I wasn't dying to see but have kind of always been curious about,
right.
and just wanted to get and finally take a look at. The last three movies I got, Birth, that Nicole Kidman film, mm-hmm. and The Human Stain with Anthony Hopkins and Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
I guess I'm on a Kidman kick here. And also I got Bowfinger. So, and I did watch Bowfinger.
Worth seeing for Eddie Murphy's performance alone, I think.
Who's Eddie Murphy?
Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, the last three I got, director's cut of Blade Runner, Gone with the Wind,
mm-hmm.
overlooked by you and overlooked
yes.
by me since I was 12, and House of Sand and Fog, another one I think they would fall exactly into that category. Heard a lot of great things about mm-hmm. it, nominated for a couple of Oscars, didn't get a chance to see it because it looked unbelievably depressing, but worth making some time for,
yeah.
I think. Sign up for a free PeerFlix account now by going to peerflix.com/filmspotting or filmspotting.net, and you'll be entered to win Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope,
mm-hmm.
a new two-disc DVD out this week, along with Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, as well as my very least favorite movie of the year, the single film I think I've given a single star rating to.
That's true.
Josh Hartnett in Lucky Number 11. We reviewed that back on 92, show 92. Also, the well-reviewed Romanian comedy Death of Mr. Lazarescu, Goal, The Dream Begins, and Disney's The Wild, as well as the 25th anniversary edition of Taps.
It's effing beautiful, man. It's effing beautiful.
Sean Penn, Timothy Hutton, Tom Cruise.
Yeah, that's right. Tom
25
Cruise.
25 years old. That's unbelievable.
I think it was Tom Cruise's first movie, actually,
in
1981.
Right.
And that, of course, his memorable line where he goes crazy at the end and starts shooting people. I've always liked Taps. You have early Sean
sign
Penn.
Of things, yeah. Right.
Yeah, early Sean Penn, early Timothy Hutton.
Yeah.
I like both those actors. So
yeah.
It's a good movie and one that I considered for the giveaway. We considered, but
yeah.
ultimately, you got to go.
How many
I
nostalgia
guess.
Picks can you hand
yeah,
out to people?
You got to go with Star Wars, which this two-disc set, you're getting the.
Original
version and the one that came out in like 04, which
yeah.
why you'd want to watch, I'm
have
not
no
sure.
Idea.
But you get both of them, and there are a lot of extra features, including
right.
a Lucas commentary. So that's what we'll be giving away, Star Wars 4, A New Hope. And we'll have a little bit of Star Wars talk here later in this segment as well, actually, as we take a trip down memory lane. We also wanted to thank everyone who was so generous as to donate to us through the PayPal links on our site. You can, of course, make a one-time donation or sign up for $2 a month, and we will put your nicknames
that's
on
right.
the website.
You'll be assigned a nickname.
That's
and,
right, by Sam Van Halgren, and you will find that link in the notes for this show.
Or
again,
Sam Burn Hollywood Halgren.
Okay, is that your new name?
I think so.
Okay.
The votes came in, unofficial count.
Let's talk about the poll questions. I referenced it in our review of Hollywoodland. We
yeah.
asked last week the question about Ed Norton. The question is simply, Ed Norton is the best actor working today? One of the best actors working today, somewhat overrated or wildly overrated, and Sam, the film spotting audience has spoken.
Yes, they have, and according to that film spotting audience, Ed Norton is one of the best actors working today. Signed, sealed, and delivered.
71%.
Yeah, send him a certificate. 71%. Yeah, right behind that, 23%, somewhat overrated. And then at 4%, wildly overrated, and only 3% of film spotting listeners believe Ed Norton to be the very best actor working today.
Okay, I guess not a big surprise there.
No.
You're going to get maybe a lot of people that really love him,
sure.
and then that second group that thinks, why does everyone like him? We got some good emails on
but
it,
some hardcore Ed Norton film fan lovers.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, this week's poll question, go to filmspotting.net and vote. The movie's coming out this weekend. Basically is what we're asking you about. The two big releases are The Black Dahlia, the Brian De Palma film, and The Last Kiss from mm-hmm. Zach Braff, or at least starring Zach Braff. And so we want to know, which movie will you see next weekend?
Right, The Black Dahlia, The Last Kiss. We'll see them both, or looks like I'm staying home again this weekend. Adam?
Yeah, well, we're going to see them
both.
Of course,
yes.
We have to. But I was thinking about, even though The Black Dahlia was earlier on my list of anticipated films, because it's De Palma and I kind of like the Hollywood sleazy, Hollywood
you're a huge
subject
Hartnett
matter.
Fan, right?
And, yeah, huge Josh Hartnett fan, right? I was leaning towards that, but I have to say now I am actually maybe a little bit more curious about The Last Kiss.
AKA,
if I had to pick,
Garden State 2. Right.
If I had to pick just one of them, I might actually pick The Last Kiss just because I'm curious about what Braff will do next. And I am not really interested in looking forward to seeing. Not really interested in Josh Hartnett. Just his narration in the preview is enough to bore me to tears. So
and I have to say this too. I don't know if it's come up or I felt like we've received a couple of emails or maybe it's actually on the message board. The discussion of the Black Dahlia in terms of people's enthusiasm for it. I for one am not a De Palma fan. I know
mm-hmm.
that there are a lot of people that are really passionate about him. I haven't been impressed by really just about anything I've seen.
I'm not
him.
A De Palma nut either.
Not a nut. And so nothing really about this excites me other than the fact that it looks like they may be, you know, not doing great service to a James Ellroy novel, which I've always been interested in, haven't read, but really curious about. And this just doesn't, it doesn't feel like, you know, the next L.A. Confidential.
Okay, so if you had to vote, which
if I had
one?
To vote, I think I probably would be more curious about The Last Kiss myself, honestly.
Okay, well, interesting. We'll see what happens. And maybe, I mean, this is a case where you are influencing programming. If the votes come back wildly in favor of The Last Kiss, we'll feature that as the main review on the show instead of The Black Dahlia, or maybe even in place of The Black Dahlia, depending on how busy our weekends are. But we do plan to see both of them and review both of them. So anyway, if you want to vote, go to filmspotting.net. We also wanted to acknowledge an email here from one of our listeners, Luke in London, who says he loves the podcast, but one request, though. He says he knows we've got a lot to cover, but we don't talk a lot about European cinema. It seems bizarre to not even hear us acknowledge such weighty events as Cannes or Almodovar's Volver. Well, there's an easy answer for that one, I think, and that is, first of all, Cannes, well, we weren't there.
We weren't invited.
We weren't invited, and we didn't apply.
And
so,
most of our listeners also are not seeing these films. These aren't films that are really going to be relevant to a lot of people until later they're released.
Yeah, and maybe it was worth spending a few moments saying, hey, this is the film that won, we'll consider that for future shows, but it didn't really cross our mind. It didn't seem like a big deal at the time. But with Volver, we haven't talked about it just because it's not really scheduled to come out here in the States until November and maybe even mid-November, but don't think for a second that we're not excited about the next Almodovar film, and we are definitely planning on reviewing it, and I wanted to use this opportunity to mention that because Luke wrote in about that, and someone else wrote in, I'm sorry I don't have your name in front of me, about the Pedro Almodovar Festival that's going on,
Viva Pedro.
You can go to vivapedro.com, where they're re-releasing 8 of his films, remastered, re-releasing them in theaters and rolling them out in big cities at different times. And it started the first day of September in Chicago, playing at the Music Box, and his first film was on display there, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. I had not seen it. I went to see it last weekend. Sam, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Everyone out there, you
wished it had been included in our Screwball Marathon.
It very well could have been a screwball comedy. It is attempting to be a screwball comedy, and it could have been part of our festival if we weren't doing old-school Hollywood films, and it might have been the best film in the marathon. It's that funny and that good, and I just have to say, what I love about Almodovar, you talk about people who love cinema, the references in this film, but especially the way he uses them, are so great. So many Hitchcock references, and there's an entire Rear Window sequence that is hilarious, but The Wizard of Oz, I mean, there's at least 10 Hollywood movie references, maybe more like 20 or 30. I wonder if someone's gone through and cataloged them all. Some I even got, but I didn't know what he was referencing, but I knew it was a reference to something, but I couldn't remember.
There's
the film.
There's
joy in that. Yeah, there is a joy in that. It's a great film. So go to vivapedro.com.
Yeah, and that festival is touring the country. I mean, it's being rolled out, again, through the end of the year. I think it ends up in Portland, Oregon or something in December, late December. But just because you're in a smaller market, don't think this isn't coming through, because I think in many cases it is.
Yeah, it is hitting some various sized markets. And so we do really recommend it. I'm planning on seeing all 8, even the few that I've seen already, in the theaters. I know 3 more are rolling out this week in Chicago. So anyway, we highly recommend it. And, you know, Women on the Verge, the thing about some of these films is you go to Netflix or PureFlix or whatever, and you have to save them because they're not really available on DVD. And that's why, if you have the chance, go see it. It's a brilliant film. Okay, we also wanted to read this note. A few listeners wrote in mentioning to us that, you know, Rian Johnson, who we had recently on the show, the writer-director of Brick, apparently he directed a music video for this band, The Mountain Goats. And you can find this clip on YouTube. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. Have you, Sam?
I haven't, no. But I know there's a Grinnell connection, I think.
A
friend of ours, Kevin Rich, I think was running the
cafe
there, the coffee house. And I think the lead singer, actually, the Mountain Goats is one guy, primarily, in fact. And I think was dating a classmate of yours, I think, at Grinnell. And Kevin booked him at the local coffee house, which I think, you know, I think I only know that because Kevin has mentioned it on numerous occasions.
Of course,
just sealing that deal. So.
Yeah, it is. So the Mountain Goats, yes, came and performed, and you can see that video. We'll put the link to that YouTube clip, again, in the notes for this show on our site. Check that out. See what else Rian Johnson has done as you anticipate his next film. We also have just a little bit here of illusionist feedback. We really want to devote the bulk of this segment to the top 5 high school movies because we got a lot of great stuff. But briefly, we got this one from Tomas Harangi in L.A.
Yeah.
With some interesting comments agreeing with me on The Illusionist.
Of course. So let me read that. I'm praising you.
Please do.
It's been my pleasure.
Wait.
Hey, guys, I feel that there are many bones that I can pick with this movie. I understand one may or may not connect with Edward Norton's performance, and the story does require a particular type of suspension of disbelief, but there is one element that really counterweighs every flaw. The meticulous visual style of the film is well worth the price of admission, in my book. I haven't seen this attention to detail and the synergy between a director, a cinematographer, and a production designer in a long time. The painstaking deconstruction of the silent film look has me glued to my seat, and I was happy to hear Adam picking up on this intention by the filmmakers. There is a true joy of silent cinema that seems to have gone into making this movie.
Well,
he remains a Cinecrack addict.
Good. I couldn't agree more. Obviously, I really like the film. I actually voted in a poll on some other site the other day about the surprise movie of the summer, and it was
You're
The Illusionist
for
me.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I really recommend
what about
it to
the breakup?
Everyone. Well, that was maybe more of a surprise, certainly, because I went in with lower expectations, but I really like The Illusionist a lot. And we did get some people, of course, who wrote in agreeing with you, Sam, and some of them focused mainly on the ending of the film, which we didn't talk about during our review because there's not really an easy way to talk about the ending of the film without giving some things away, and we don't want to do that, so that's also why we're avoiding reading those emails.
Right. But I want to give you credit. I mean, you honestly made such an interesting case for the way you saw that movie that it did make me curious to see it again, because I have to say, I was aware of how the look of the film wasn't working for me, but it, you know, was obviously working on a level I just didn't understand
and fully appreciate. I mean, maybe a second time you could. So anyway, well, I'm glad I can be persuasive, you know, one out of every 100 shows or so.
Right,
Sam,
we're getting there.
We also have some interesting emails here. We referenced it in the tease. We both got some interesting family connections emails over the past week that we want to share on the show. And Sam, why don't you go ahead and get this one started? And this references early movie memories, an unofficial top five we did a while back, and it's one of those top fives that we haven't even had a chance really to get into the feedback, but maybe the second or third most feedback we've ever got about a top five.
And
was,
it wasn't about pissing people off either.
No.
It's not like the most overrated movies.
Exactly.
Which just hurt people's wrath.
People just enjoyed taking that trip down memory lane with us and thinking themselves about what were their early movie memories. And we wanted to share this one here from Julie Versteeg in Oskaloosa,
Julie
Iowa.
Julie Versteeg writes, "Dear Adam and Sam, I remember begging to go see Star Wars when it came out, declaring it too scary for kids. My parents refused to take me. Imagine how hard it was to swallow when my younger cousin, Adam Kempinar, came to visit one day, toting his vast collection of Star Wars action figures, a big Millennium Falcon, and a handheld camera that showed clips from the movie when you cranked it. Adam had not only seen the movie, he'd memorized the jargon and character names and played out the plot over and over. It was the only glimpse I got of the movie. I wasn't allowed to see Star Wars or The Empire Strikes Back in the theater, and this pipsqueak not only saw them, he lived them. Adam taught me the names and roles of the action figures. I eventually saw Star Wars and Empire on cable and caught Jedi in the large theater with a curved screen because I went with a friend and her father, but I'm not bitter. I should have known then that Adam would go on to share his love of film with others. I'm glad to report that we gave my 10-year-old son, Joseph, a box set of the entire Star Wars saga for Christmas when it came out. Even at the ripe old age of 10, he recognized that the first three just weren't as good, and he bears no emotional scars from watching the scary Star Wars movies."
Yeah,
clearly you didn't either.
No, a great email from my cousin Julie. It was really nice to hear from her. And what she's referencing there with the scary Star Wars movies is at the top of the email, she mentions that growing up, her mother, my Aunt Karen, they attended a small Christian Reformed Church that discouraged things like watching movies and listening to the radio and doing some of that stuff that we'll get to reference again in Massacre Theater this
week. I was just
week.
Thinking that.
Yeah, and so they didn't go to movies all that often, and again, she was kind of forbidden to go see Star Wars. And so,
then again, I mean, based on my own early movie memories, I mean, the scariness of these movies,
very
I can
similar.
Totally relate
you
to.
You and Julie should have hung out as kids. It would have been great. But it is great to hear from Julie. And in reading that, you know, I don't remember sharing that stuff with her. I must have been only 6, 7,
or
8.
There are pictures.
She's a few years older, but I just must have been insufferable.
I mean, can't imagine.
No.
Oh, I can't imagine
I can't
all.
Either. So,
I would have loved to have heard you told the story of Star Wars over and over again.
Repeating all
In
the
fact,
lines.
After recording, I want you to tell me the
story.
Okay,
I'll do it. But I do remember having all those things, though. The Millennium Falcon, the action figures, the movie cranked.
The AT-AT. Do you remember? I had the AT-AT.
No, I didn't.
Remember that from
no,
Empire Strikes Back?
I didn't.
Oh,
but
awesome.
I had this thing. I can't remember what it actually was called now, but it was something where you reeled it, I think, and it showed you scenes from the film. It was awesome.
Yeah,
okay.
The 80s
well,
were awesome.
Sam has his own family connection here. We've got this one from Ben in Denver City.
Denver
that
City,
would be,
USA.
That would be Ben Hallgren. He's not Ben Van Hallgren,
no,
is he?
No, he's not.
He must not be related then.
He'll wait till he gets married.
Okay, well, he writes and he says, D-A-R-Y-L. I don't know how you could forget such a traumatic experience. Fast Times, which you mentioned, Sam, the horrific experience of watching this as a young kid and your mom
with a
yanking
friend over.
It, yanking it out of the VCR. So Ben saying, how could you forget this? Fast Times was taken out and replaced by Daryl. After a lengthy trip back to the movie store while your friend sat quietly in horror, I seem to recall a time in Daryl when someone said shit and our entire living room sat in suspense to see our mother's reaction. Awkward times at Bolton Borough Academy. Also, just so Sam doesn't feel alone, I have also yet to see Pretty in Pink or many of the other classics of the 80s. They, in our household, were seen as garbage.
It's true. It was my dad. What garbage are you watching? Uh-huh. That way he'd walk in from work, that his line every day.
Nice. I think to relate to Adam's Breakfast Club experience, I think The Sound of Music is the only thing Sam and I saw that many times. So revealing, Sam.
Unbelievable.
It is a wonder we ever made it out of Huxley's, New Hampshire.
Well, it's amazing. I know a little too much about Barrett Oliver. I think the star of Daryl, also the star of Neverending Story, another one you haven't seen.
I feel like
he was the third sibling in our household. There was me, there was Ben, and there was Daryl, the robotic boy.
Daryl.
Loved Daryl.
I always thought Daryl was so lame when I was a kid. I was too advanced. I was into the dirty raunchy. I was watching Porky's and stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say Porky's, exactly.
Yeah, okay. Well, we do have a bunch
Bachelor
of great...
Party, right.
Yeah, there you go. Bachelor Party, one of my favorites. We have a lot of great high school movie top five feedback to get into, and we will do that coming up here later in the show. If you do have feedback for us, send us an email or a short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA. That's 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
When we come back, let's hear it for the boy. Come on, join in. It's Film Spotting sing-along time next in Massacre Theater. Plus, Adam and I hang out with Bob Dylan circa 1965 for a discussion of Don't Look Back. Stay with us.
When I saw Marlon Brando on the big screen like a hero, made me act and feel like one too. Took 3 or 4 hours, felt like no one could touch me. I skidded back to feeling like I do. I'm lost, crazy, lonesome, a plane with no place to land. And I make me feel like a man. Make me feel like a man.
I know why you don't call me up.
I wanted to tell you myself.
Oh, well, I know why you don't want to see me anymore. Hey, I'm not stupid. I'm not blind. It's McCormick, ain't it? You're just dying to screw McCormick, aren't you? Aren't you?
You're so stupid.
Stupid? You think I don't see you looking at him like some bitch in heat? You'd wrap those skinny legs around anybody, won't
you? Shut up!
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from Footloose. That was Jim Youngs as Chuck Cranston and Laurie Singer as Ariel Moore in the 1984 Kevin Bacon vehicle, a tie-in with last week's top five high school movies. A lot of impassioned responses to this Massacre Theater.
Definitely.
Loved it. Some declaring it the best movie of the 80s, in fact.
It might be.
And it may be. Reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Keith Van Norman.
What's that?
Van Norman.
Oh, it's catching like wildfire.
Yeah, I think you rigged. You rigged this random selection here.
I don't know.
Keith Van Norman from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Oh, you'll agree with this,
Keith.
If you ain't Dutch, you ain't much.
Well, I certainly agree with that. Congratulations.
I'm waiting
to Keith
for my honorary, certificate.
Your
from
wooden shoes?
Yeah, my wooden shoes.
Okay, well, email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Ta-tay-tee-toe-too.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
Time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and the only clue I'm going to give to this one, Sam, you picked it, and I think maybe this is a movie that your mom actually allowed you and Ben to watch in your house growing
up.
I don't know.
Was this
too racy?
Going on. This is way too racy.
Okay, well, are you going to start it?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and start it, and all I'll say is we are not remotely here making any attempt at doing the actual
convey
voices.
The characters, that's
I
right.
know we tried with In America and, of course, failed miserably. But here, we're not going to just.
I couldn't possibly do it justice. Or it would give it away.
It would give it way too away.
I almost want to try it.
I'd love to hear you try it.
I would too.
I can't do it. I can't do it.
Couldn't do it. All right.
I'm not equipped.
All right.
Okay.
Give me the action.
I'm going to give you the action. And action.
You can come with us.
Where are you going?
We're following our dreams.
Really? I have a dream too.
What?
You might think it's stupid.
No.
Well, I want to go to Bombay, India to become a movie star.
You don't go to Bombay to become a movie star. You go where we're going. Hollywood.
Well, sure, if you want to do it the easy way.
Easy way? I don't know.
insane. If you know what film we just massacred, send us an email by Monday, September 18th, to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show.
Right.
I was out there.
I don't care who was it. Hey, no, I don't want none of your shit, man.
I'm not
glass in the street.
I'm not giving you shit.
What'd you do it for, man? What'd you throw a glass in the street?
I didn't throw a glass in the street.
Well, show me the person that did. If you don't have him here, man,
I'm not
going to tip. You better take responsibility for it. All right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You got him here?
No.
Hey, man, I'm not kidding you.
I'm
kidding?
All right, that's a scene, or at least part of a scene, from my favorite sequence in D.A. Pennebaker's Don't Look Back, Bob Dylan arguing with Donovan. Really funny stuff that hopefully we'll get into. But Pennebaker followed Dylan to England to chronicle his British tour in 1965, combines fly-on-the-wall footage of Dylan with the media, his entourage, including fellow folkie and girlfriend at the time, Joan Baez, and Dylan in performance. And when you read anything about this movie, Sam, everyone is quick to bring up how shortly after the tour ended, Dylan went electric. The folk music icon embraced rock, pissed off his legion of fans in the process, and me being a big fan of the band, I'm well aware of this history because they were his band, backing band.
Well, that other tour,
when he went electric.
Right?
So my question is for you, is the movie made more interesting with this knowledge, with the benefit of hindsight, knowing that this was coming shortly after the film was done, or is it perhaps only interesting when you know that you are seeing an artist in transition?
It's so hard to say. I mean, I think this movie is absolutely made more interesting when seen from the vantage point of the impact, the sheer incalculable impact that Bob Dylan had on music since the 60s. How much it had to do with, you know, him breaking with this folky past after this tour of England in 65, I don't know how much that much more adds to it. I just was mesmerized by this entire film from start to finish, and I had a hard time deciding throughout if it's that I just happen to love Dylan's music and the brief concert footage of him playing Hank Williams tunes in his bedroom are just to me absolutely 100% compelling, and I'm like, is it the movie or is it just the man himself?
Yeah.
Dylan was 25 years old at the time, which is really hard to imagine when you're watching this, and I think that what I'd heard about this film, less that it captured a time right before he went electric, in fact, he'd already recorded the electric album that brought him infamy, is that he was arrogant. That's what I remember. I mean, whenever I heard about this film, it was that he came across as incredibly, incredibly arrogant, particularly in his dealings with the press. I mean, at least half this film is him being interviewed by some press or other. And he didn't once come across as arrogant to me, really.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Well, no, I mean, for me, there was one scene, the scene when he's being interviewed by Time Magazine.
Yeah.
That is, but to me, I saw somebody who was incredibly self-possessed and largely polite. But what he had to deal with was, you know, the press asking him really kind of ridiculous questions.
Yes.
And really having to just, I think he was trying to keep a sense of humor about it. He knew that this thing was being filmed, too. And Pennebaker has admitted to the fact that Dylan, in large parts, was putting on a character persona while this thing was being filmed, and didn't blame him for that at all. At the same time, you're seeing a lot of, I think, Dylan, the man himself,
being
as he was at
the
time. Absolutely authentic. But to me, I saw somebody that everybody that spoke to him, whether it was the press or it was fans, they wanted something from him. They wanted his approval. They wanted his friendship. They wanted him to explain what was, you know, what the kids were thinking or whatever
like
it was.
Moses coming down from the
and
mountain.
And he at no point pretends that he has the answers. And I absolutely loved it. I was never turned off by his persona. And you have to wonder with that scene with the interviewer from Time Magazine, and he is just lambasting this poor guy.
Yeah.
You have to wonder what happened just before that scene. Whether the guy asked a kind of ridiculous question. The scene starts and all of a sudden you just have Dylan being totally condescending. He's like, are you going to come to the concert? Are you going to hear the concert? Are you going to listen to the concert? You may not understand all the words. And it really is startling, but watching the entire film up to that point, you've already seen him being asked so many inane questions, having people just treat him so strangely, and him just trying to retain a sense of self. I honestly didn't even blame him.
Yeah, no, I didn't realize how just early in his career this was until I read it later, that he was only 25. And
it's
it
amazing.
Is somehow easy to forget because he's already such an accomplished artist. And you even go into the film maybe a lot like the press does, expecting more from him, expecting almost the Bob Dylan of old, or right, a wiser Bob Dylan to be able, you know, to articulate everything that he sings about in his songs. And that's not there. And you realize then, okay, he's 25. He's out on the road.
To be
no,
either.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. And so when he's petulant and childish and combative, which he is,
yeah,
you can forgive him for that a
yeah
little bit. And the only one you really can't forgive him for, I don't think, is the one with the Time Critic.
Yeah,
and you're
right.
Tough, you wonder
right
if something before he even came in the room may have sparked that or
sure
what. But that's the only time where Dylan really felt to me like he was being deliberately combative and just in some way reveling in his status
right
and his ability to say whatever he wants. And unfortunately, he doesn't actually say anything smart in that entire sequence.
No, he doesn't.
In that time with the
no
with the Time guy,
no,
he doesn't say anything that's interesting.
He doesn't really make a case.
In his
yeah
critique of Time and the media and everything,
yeah,
he really doesn't make a good case at all. It's not very smart. And so he actually does come off in that moment looking kind of dumb, I think, and,
yeah,
and arrogant.
Or his age, in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's kind of all over the place, his reasoning. And so I don't know what to make of that scene completely, but you're right. I had the same reaction as you early in the film, and it is what drew me into the film ultimately, is when they're asking him all these questions, the media does, in some moments, bring this on themselves.
Absolutely.
They deserve his responses. When you ask a folk singer like Dylan, or really any artist, to explain succinctly his message.
Yeah.
It's a great question in that if you can actually find an artist who is willing to take the time to try to give you a really thoughtful answer
right
and to actually break down all of their music into one sentence or two, that's great if you can get them to do that. But if you can't, then it's a really stupid question because how do you answer it? I've thought about this in relation to other artists and artists
yeah
I love, and
sometimes right
you see them ask this kind of question. How does Bob Dylan, if I was him, and I've written all these songs that people adore and are hopefully saying something interesting, how do you then tell someone, well, this is what they all mean? It's there in the music.
It's there in the music.
It's there
in the lyrics.
Listen
yeah
to it.
Right.
Listen to it. But even if Dylan can't probably articulate exactly what he's saying, how
right
do you? These are, it's a whole catalog of music.
Right.
It's not as
right
if he's trying to say one thing.
With
and when they ask
song,
those kind
yeah
of questions, you want to provide, you know, a petulant response. You don't blame him at all for it.
But I think it's just, he's not even petulant or arrogant or cruel to
it's
them.
True.
He's just asking them to ask a straight question.
Yeah.
Ask a question that you would answer if you were asked the same question.
Right.
And he has that really heated exchange, but it's not even heated. And you, I'm not even sure if he's a member of the press, but it's just sort of this younger guy who, you know, it looks just terrible. I mean, he's having this really awkward conversation, and Dylan is just like, what do you mean? I mean, really,
yeah,
what do you want? You want me to be your friend?
Right.
Why?
That
why
guy was
I think
so annoying.
Really annoying, but you also saw Dylan just being like, everyone has given him power. People walk into the room and give him power. Strangers give him power, and all he's doing is kind of toying with it. He's just saying like, what if I don't answer the question
right
you're asking me? Really, I'm just challenging a little bit the
right
status quo. I'm not going to be in awe of the BBC.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to be in awe of Time Magazine. And it's like, I think those are good questions without saying, and again, that exchange with Time Magazine, he's basically saying there's no point to Time Magazine. I don't think he actually believes it,
right,
and he doesn't make a very good case for it. But the fact of him just sort of challenging this notion when he's not a revolutionary. He doesn't see himself
right
that way. He's making revolutionary music that revolutionized music. But
and other people see that way, and that's what
right
it's all about, is how they listen and
right
interpret it. And so, yeah, I agree with you. It's funny that, again, that kind of moment of explain to us your message. I was shaking
yeah
my head throughout, and I love the fact that he just was willing to acknowledge that that's not my job is to write the songs.
Yeah.
My job is not to explain the songs to you.
Right.
And so I didn't blame him
no,
for any
either
of those moments at all. And I do think that on the whole, what is the most fun about the film are those impromptu music exchanges with
yeah
him and Joan Baez.
Oh,
they're
yeah
probably the most interesting because you get the sense that they aren't performing for anyone but themselves.
Well, they're
really
singing those Hank Williams
yeah
songs.
Yeah, the Hank Williams
yeah
songs. You really get the sense that this is exactly how they pass the time,
yep,
by kind of trying to impress each other and one-up
yeah
each other, but also just performing for each other. And that feels totally real to me. And I think that, again, this is something I talked about with high school a little bit last week in my top five high school movies, the Frederick Wiseman
right
documentary, is that you just don't get documentaries like this anymore. It's just not the way we view film anymore and the perspective people bring. And I'm not saying it's bad or good.
Mm-hmm.
I love documentaries that we see today. But this kind of fly-on-the-wall approach, the verite thing, you actually do get the feeling. And again, you don't know what they're cutting out.
Yeah.
The commentary, the perspective is more in the editing than in anything.
Sure.
But you get the sense that, you know, when you're seeing Dylan just laying on his bed reading a newspaper, you know, that he's not performing for anyone.
Right.
And so you really feel like there are even times where the camera, there's a discussion, a negotiation going on between his manager, Albert Grossman, and this other guy in the BBC.
Totally fascinating.
And it is totally fascinating. And it really feels like he's almost the D.A. Pennebaker is hiding behind something
yeah.
to make sure they don't really notice him. And you never feel like they do notice him. If they do, we can't know. They know they're being observed. But those authentic moments, that fly-on-the-wall approach, is really interesting. And I read on Netflix, you know, people were reviewing it and people were raving about it on Netflix. But someone gave it like one star and they're like, I couldn't even hear what they were saying. This is bad because I couldn't hear what they were saying, and there's no subtitles on the DVD. Well, I'll admit, I tried to turn the subtitles on, too. I was hoping they were there because it is very mumbly, and it is hard to hear exactly what they're saying, but that's the technology of the time, and you got to just kind of give it a break.
But you have to give it credit for the advance of technology at the time.
Exactly.
And one of the successes of this film, and I was listening to the commentary, was that you had this, you know, you had this meeting of this revolutionary aspect of music, what Bob Dylan was doing to music, which seems very simple, and of course we've all taken it for granted at this point, but also what D.A. Pennebaker did. I mean, he really invented a camera that could collect
more lightweight
sound, more lightweight, where these people didn't actually, in many cases, not Dylan and his cronies, but people didn't realize they were being filmed, certainly by any media, because what he was holding looked like just a home video camera.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no sense of them having to put on, there was no lighting. You know, they could do everything in a self-contained thing. And, you know, some of those concert, that concert footage where Pennebaker is like on the floor, you know, while he's singing "Death of Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll," which is just this mesmerizing scene. Again, it's just him and the camera, which just hadn't been done before.
Right. No, it is. It's interesting. And another little hindsight note that makes it interesting to watch, too, is that you come to find out he and Joan Baez were breaking up.
Yeah.
During this time. And you go back and watch those scenes and how they interact, you know, it's made a little bit more interesting when you consider that little nugget. But I also think that Dylan, on the whole, despite what you think of him, and I didn't have a chance to look this up, so maybe I'm misquoting this, but I seem to remember Roger Ebert mentioning seeing Don't Look Back originally and really liking it, and watching it more recently and realizing that he just thinks Dylan is just annoying and arrogant and all
I
those
remember
things.
That.
And he's not,
yes,
he doesn't enjoy him
that same
at
thing.
All. And so he ultimately doesn't then like the film.
It's incredible.
But you know what? Even though we've talked about this stuff already at length, the way he comes off, but Dylan is such an intriguing character because he is just enigmatic. And that's enough for me. I mean, he's a guy who at once comes off as someone who is really full of himself, someone who does on some level see his importance in the folk music scene, in the music world. There's a running joke throughout about his feud, quote-unquote, with Donovan.
Donovan. Yeah, that's very
he
funny.
Seems to be at once trying to put it off, but at the same time seems to be bothered
by
him.
Well, the scene
he
when they're in the same room and play the two songs back-to-back.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like in your face.
That's
with
a competition.
Donovan absolutely.
Performs.
Well,
that's
like
why you
got to
watch it. It is, exactly. Donovan performs a song, and everyone's rapt.
And it's a nice song.
And attention.
Yeah,
and it's
fine.
But then Dylan's like, you know, Dylan's not just going to pull out some crappy tune. He's going to get up and play something good, and he's trying to one-up Donovan and show, hey, kid, you're doing a nice job, but I'm the man. And
sings, so, yeah, it's all over now, baby. Blue.
Exactly. And it's fascinating. That
but
whole
he totally
scene
crushes
awesome.
Him.
He does crush
and the
him.
Thing is, it's late at night. They're a little drunk. And you can tell, like, Dylan is singing his throat out. He doesn't have to. But he's like, yeah, it was a nice little, he even says to Donovan, nice little song, give me the guitar.
Right.
And then he kicks, and I mean, part of it, you know, it's a classic song by now. It's a brilliant song.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows, watching it at the time, maybe you hadn't heard that song before. It's hard to know, but in retrospect, watching Donovan's face as the camera pans back to him after Dylan's done singing the song, you can't help but think, like, Donovan thinking, I'll never write a song that good.
Yeah, no, you wonder.
It's that good.
And you're right. Like, again, we kind of do this throughout these marathons. We kind of try to highlight our favorite moments. And my favorite moment alone from this marathon so far, our first film in, is just any of the shots of Donovan's face while watching Dylan sing. And the thing is about it is you can project onto them. I said this about high school, too.
Right.
You wonder, maybe Donovan wasn't thinking at all.
Maybe not.
Maybe he was totally unimpressed.
Yep.
But watching it,
yep.
that's not the sense you have.
Exactly.
And so it's really interesting to watch. And just his face kind of going, oh, crap, I'm being schooled here.
I don't have
Dylan.
Another tune.
I don't have another song that's worth playing. Is interesting. So, again, I think, you know, Dylan's a puzzle. And the way he comes off as a guy who's totally full of himself and yet someone who, at the same time, I mean, talk about a contradiction, doesn't seem to care at all what anybody thinks of
that's
him.
The
I
thing.
Mean, it's
And
it's
he's
weird.
Not a preacher. Yeah, there really is. I thought it was completely fascinating. And watched the film again with the commentary, and they sort of talk in and on and off, you know, and it's more compelling the second time.
Really?
I mean, there's a sense of discovery in spending time with these people, but there's something about the way the film is edited that makes it, for me, absolutely compelling. Dylan, the character, compelling.
Yeah. Okay, well, that is the first film in our marathon, and the six films that are in our marathon, if you want the complete list, go to filmspotting.net and click on the marathon's link. Play along at home.
That's right. Next week, Barbara Koppel's Oscar-winning documentary about a 1973 Kentucky coal miner strike, Harlan County, USA.
All these films, and this is why we do these marathons. I mean, Don't Look Back, the fact that we've never seen it.
Man.
Ridiculous. The fact that we've never seen Harlan County. that's why they're in this marathon, and we can't wait to watch
them. And
him,
I think, too, you mean Dylan just released a new album 2 weeks ago, and he's still a legitimate force in music. I love the quote recently where he said, there hasn't been a decent record produced in 20 years. This is the same kind of
it's
character.
The same guy.
You know, he doesn't, whether he means it or not.
He's being provocative.
He's being provocative.
Yeah,
okay. It was 30 years, 40 years ago.
Yep. Time for one more quick break. When we come back, get ready for your close-up. We'll count down our top five movies about Hollywood next.
Legend and bloody, walking around from memory, scared and lost and broken, only the whiskey's still talking to me. I'm quiet at the big apartment building there in town. Mammy said, yeah, we got one room, and as he said it, he frowned. He said that room is bad luck, couldn't rent it out, I wouldn't try.
And Sir Van Halgren, three things about your movies that make me cry, top five. First off, Forrest Gump, Adam, you got it right on the head. I actually hate that movie with a passion. I hate everything until that final line and Tom Hanks' amazing Oscar-worthy delivery of the final line of that movie of, is he smart or is he? Secondly, if I had to make a list, it would probably be the Cameron Crowe, Paul Thomas Anderson memorial list. I can just think of Lester Bangs' pep talk to a crying, defeated William Miller near the end of Almost Famous about being uncool. Anything Jerry Maguire and Renee Zellweger do together. The father-son issues in Magnolia. The musical number in Magnolia. Adam Sandler and Emily Watson's embracing each other in that Hawaiian hotel lobby and that amazing shot. And then their last line together saying, here we go. But if I had to pick my number one You'll Make Me Cry moment of the past 5 years, it would have to be Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. When, near the very end of the movie, when Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet are in that house where they first met in his dreams, in his mind, and it's the last memory they have of each other since it's the first time they met. And I think I'm breaking up right now as I'm saying it, maybe not, and the house is coming tumbling down just like his final memory of her is, thinking he's going to lose her forever. So I guess you two jocks cry at your sports flicks, and I guess I'm destroyed to tears when the guy loses the girl. Yup, I'm a big wuss, and I'm a longtime film spotting fan.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and that was another bit of audio feedback there from Anonymous.
Anonymous.
When you leave us a voicemail, especially
you're going to tell us
like
you're going to cry, yeah. Tell us who you are.
We want to know who you are and where you're from, but we do appreciate that. Kind of a little bit of a longer voicemail than we
really
usually
nice,
play,
yeah.
But really nice, so we wanted to include it. And of course, we are going to have some more feedback here in a minute as we get to our top five high school movies. In fact, let's go ahead, Sam, and do that right now.
Yeah, okay, so
because
looking back on
people,
our high school movies.
Yeah, looking
right.
back at high school, we had our top five high school movies last week, tying in with just being back to school,
yeah,
really, was
right.
the tie-in.
Exactly.
And
back
we needed a
time.
Top five, and so that was it.
That's right.
And it was interesting, actually, Dominique in Montreal, good regular listener, Dominique, she sent us a link and said, apparently we weren't the only ones thinking about this because
yeah.
Entertainment Weekly just recently did their top 50 high school movies. And
right.
of course, the nine films that we had on our list, because we did have one overlap. So the nine films from our top 10, all of them were, as you would expect, on EW's top 50. And I want to mention them quickly. Here was their top 10. Ferris Bueller, number 10. It was our Ferris Bueller Memorial list, of
right.
course. Election, which was on your list. Boys in the Hood. Clueless. American Graffiti, Heathers, Rebel Without a Cause, and then their top three, Dazed and Confused, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and The Breakfast Club. So
right.
from my top five, they had their top three were in my top three, exactly in that order, actually. Yeah. Dazed, Fast Times, and The Breakfast Club. You also had Fast Times and Election from the top 10. Your others from your top five, Stand and Deliver, they had at 43.
Represent.
Yeah, and Brick, they had at 35, and they had nice. Rushmore at 24. My list, Frederick Wiseman's High School was 13.
Wow.
And Grease, that's right, was 21. And we have a nice email there, Sam. Why don't you go ahead and read it right now
let me read
time.
This. Subject line, crying doesn't make you gay. Liking the movie Grease does. This one from Greg Niemack in Pleasantville, New York, who writes, what's next, Adam? St. Elmo's Fire?
Hey, do not knock St. Elmo's Fire ever.
By the way, Greg writes, Grease as a stage musical is not a bad thing. He wants to set the record straight. The movie is. He blames Alan Carr, the writer-producer of both Grease movies, the Village People's Can't Stop the Music, and the man who put Snow White and Rob Lowe on stage at the Oscars dancing and singing Proud Mary. Carr has his own entry in Jane and Michael Stern, sadly out of print, Encyclopedia of Bad Taste.
Well,
as you should.
If it's bad, if Grease is bad, then I don't want to be right. I don't want to be good.
I don't know what's right.
Okay, because I love Grease, and nice. That's all there is to it.
Now, how many scenes in, I just want to say, I'm looking at EW's top 10 here. How many scenes in Boys in the Hood took place in a high school?
Well, that was
building?
The thing. It's a bizarre choice for that reason. I agree
to
completely.
To be that high.
To be that high. Yeah. I had the exact same reaction. But I wanted to mention, Sam, give you a little bit of credit here. Because anybody out there, I know you're probably sick of us talking about the movie Brick. But they had Brick at 35.
Yeah.
And they articulate it the exact same way you did. Maybe a little bit better because it's more concise and clearer. I think you'll admit to that. But if anyone out there is thinking, what was Sam talking about? How could Brick really be a high school movie? Listen to what they say. With a femme fatale, a dead girlfriend, and a mysterious cape-wearing drug lord, Brick gives you a teen flick in the guise of a noir thriller where everything is all very life and death. Come to think of it, that's exactly what high school is like. That's exactly what you were saying.
Well written, absolutely more concise, but that is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Everything is life and death in high school. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, so I think that EW completely supported your inclusion of Brick. Nicely done
and
by
And I was
you.
A teenage kingpin. I don't know about you.
You were. Yeah, that's right.
I
just dealt
definitely.
Drugs.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I see.
But I didn't have anybody like the pin behind me. It was right. bad. Okay. Well, we also got this great email here from Sergio, champion of Illumination
nice.
Perez. He's a donor, obviously, right. in Mexico. He says, guys, I usually do not write about your choices regarding the top five, but I must this time. I did Yelp and thus became a monster with sweating teeth when I heard nothing but silence on my favorite pick in the category, Dead Poets Society. And Sergio, you weren't alone. I believe this might have been a bit ahead of your time. I'm 38, but when it came out, I was at the right age to be positively inspired by this movie. It actually could fit nicely in your previous list of movies that make you cry.
Great point.
A popular choice for that top five
Absolutely
as well.
Was.
I really do like Dead Poets Society, I have to say. I mean, I still have, right. I've only seen it once. I haven't gone back. Maybe it doesn't hold up. I don't know. But yes, at the time, just like Sergio, I loved it. I was moved by it. I thought Robin Williams was God.
Yeah.
I wanted to read poetry, you know,
right.
and all that stuff. So I was into it, and it was in contention, but just not good enough for my top 10.
Yeah, and I think it was one of these films, I don't know if it's come up on the show, but high school, I was absolutely with you on that. I mean, I remember absolutely thinking Ethan Hawke standing up on the desk. I think one of our listeners wrote immediate cause for tears.
Yeah, oh, Captain, my captain, his subject line.
I happened to catch it, though, on TV. It has to be 5 years ago now. And it was only the second half or so. And I was like, this is the most absurd movie I have ever seen. I was kind of furious with it because the idea of Robert Sean Leonard killing himself because he couldn't act in a play struck me as just completely overdramatic and completely ridiculous. And I know his dad was the bad guy and the dad from That 70s Show.
Yeah.
And I love him. He's always a bad guy. Great in actually the first.
Kurtwood Smith.
RoboCop. Great,
yeah.
One of the best villains ever.
Yeah,
I think he was
good.
On my list of great villains. But it just struck me as almost irresponsible and silly that, you know, he would respond in this way. And again, I was seeing the second half of the film. I hadn't seen it in years. I think I need to go back and see it before I completely
Maybe.
Condemn it, but
okay. No, that's
those
an
are my
interesting
lingering
argument.
Thoughts.
There's
yeah.
no doubt that it's big and melodramatic,
yeah,
but,
right,
you know,
right.
is it that absurd? I don't know.
I don't
we'll
know
see.
Either.
We also got this one, Sam. Why don't you go ahead and read this from Doug Yee.
Okay, Doug Yee writes, enjoyed the top five high school movies, but I think you guys are a little stuck in your own high school years, but who isn't? Here are three that I would have added. I'm not quite this old, but seeing these on TV or in the theater in the case of To Sir With Love shaped my expectations of high school. Number one, he's got Blackboard Jungle, introduced us to juvenile delinquents, Rock Around the Clock in Sidney Poitier as the young punk. Number two, To Sir With Love, transplant to London from New York and make Sidney Poitier 10 years older to play the teacher from the same class of kids he represented in Blackboard Jungle, plus the song, To Sir With Love. And three, finally, Rebel Without a Cause. If I remember correctly, most of the action was outside the school, but school generated the social structure for these kids This film did an outstanding job of depicting the otherness everyone feels in high school. While it's mostly revered as a component of the James Dean trilogy, I really thought Selma Nao gave a great performance.
Well, I really like Rebel Without a Cause,
I
and I have to say that I just left it off my list because it didn't take place enough in high school,
Honestly, I think Doug acknowledges.
Yeah,
I don't think I articulated, but that I think I used the same.
Okay,
criteria.
So that's why I left it off. I have not seen Blackboard Jungle. I don't think you have either.
No.
But To Sir With Love, I just have to say, that was the first film when I thought of this top five. I said, this is the one that's going to stick out the most glaring omission of a film we haven't seen.
Right.
And I've always loved the song, too, I have to say. I think Lulu, I think it's a great tune.
Yeah.
But I do want to see To Sir With Love. Haven't had a chance yet. Didn't have time last week, but it's on the list, and that is a great list from Doug. We also got this one from Joel Ahrens, who writes, your latest top five had me holding my breath and waiting for you guys to include what I believe to be the quintessential high school flick, and you did, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But what about its sister film, the wonderfully manic Clueless? I remember way back when one of you mentioning Clueless as a guilty pleasure. I don't see why. It is truly great, and it creates its own language just as Brick does. It's interesting to watch the documentary on the DVD where the creators admit that some of the language they made up and some of it was lines they'd hear kids say in the mall. The funny thing is, a lot of the language did seep into 90s teen culture. Heckerling proved that she can still write for teenagers 10 years after Fast Times, and it's a wonderful satire on California schools, or so I'm told. I'm an Australian, not an American, so what do I know? But I'm an Australian living now in Taiwan with some American friends, and I used to watch the occasional episode of 90210, so maybe I do know a little. Maybe you do, Joel. I have to say, I think I was maybe the one who said it was a guilty pleasure.
Yeah,
I really don't
been,
view it that way. I like it. It was in a recent top five. I don't see it. I don't feel guilty about liking
Nor
Clueless.
Nor should you.
For the same
You're not
reasons,
guilty about liking Grease. There's no way you
exactly
should be
right.
guilty
no,
about Clueless.
You're dead right, but just for the reasons Joel mentions are the reasons why I think Clueless really is a good and funny film.
All right, one more here. This one's from John Coletti in Wheaton, Illinois, who writes, hey, Adam and Sam, just thought you'd be interested in hearing a top five high school movies list from a current high school student. Then again, it is sadly similar to yours, although John has number five, Rebel Without a Cause. This movie is truly effective. If you've ever experienced teen angst and the time period it's in is irrelevant.
Well, I've never experienced teen angst. That's why I didn't make my list.
I've been looking forward to it, actually.
Yeah.
I'm thinking probably this next year, 32.
Maybe 32, you'll hit it?
Okay. Yeah. Too angst. I don't know. All right. Number four, Heathers. Completely unrealistic, powerful, and hilarious nonetheless. Number three, Rushmore. Funniest film about high school, enough said. Number two, The Squid and the Whale. Not much of it takes place in high school, but my small group of friends and I have already started applying the film's quotes to our daily school lives. It may seem lame, but to me, there's nothing funnier than calling the books we read Minor Twain, Minor Dickens.
Didn't we suggest that would happen?
That
I mean,
is
we had started doing it, too.
I would absolutely be doing it. I love it. And number one, Donnie Darko, Our Generation's Breakfast Club, John writes, I know you guys appreciate it, too, and it doesn't even take place in our time period, but from the funny script to the identifiable characters, there's something about this movie that makes almost everyone my age who's seen it fall in love with it, and it introduced many teens to Joy Division. Name something better than that.
Well, I do like the Mad World.
I think it was 24-hour
better,
Party People that introduced me
to
the music
Division.
Of Joy Division.
Yeah.
Of course, I'd heard of him, but
okay. Well,
good
great
list
there. Absolutely love Donnie Darko. So thank you, John, for that. But it is time to get into this week's top five as we've rambled on through the feedback here.
Right.
We now have to get to our top five, which is movies about Hollywood, tying in with Hollywoodland, conveniently, and also next week's The Black Dahlia.
Sure.
Hollywood is big now, apparently, and,
Hollywood's
and the,
so
the seamy
right
side of Hollywood. So,
so hot right now.
Popular topic. We're going to get into it with our favorite movies about Hollywood. And Sam, I'm just going to say right now that we should have had a better discussion about this.
I'm ashamed.
Because I thought I mentioned to you made it clear that we should leave off movies about movies.
I'm going through teen angst. I am not listening
You're
to
not
you.
Listening You're
my
to authority.
You're my authority figure, and I'm rebelling.
Our very first top five list ever was top five movies about movies.
That's right.
And my list included The Player,
right,
which is the only film on that list that could actually also be called a Hollywood movie.
Right.
So I left off The Player deliberately, and in fact, calling my list the Griffin Mill Memorial List.
Okay.
What did you do? How did you form your list?
Good question. I don't know. I guess for me, it came down to the fact that I did include a couple of the films that appeared on that movies about movies list, but ultimately it was just about the place. And I think thinking about our Hollywoodland review and maybe my problems with it in the fact that it didn't ever quite capture the glamour and then get to the underbelly, the dirty underbelly underneath. It was always kind of sad and depressing, Hollywoodland. And I think the films that appear on my list at least give a greater indication of like the glory, why people go there in the first place, you know, the flame that is, that draws the moths,
okay,
if you will.
So your 6 through 10?
6 through 10 are Hurley Burley, based on David Rabe's play of Sean Penn, Kevin Spacey, Robin Wright, Penn, Meg Ryan, Anna Paquin, nice little stage adaptation. The Big Picture, Christopher Guest in the 80s with Kevin Bacon. Terry Hatcher.
Martin Short.
Martin Short. It's funny. I mean, it's not as quite as consistently funny as Guest's later stuff, but it's has some nice moments. I do have The Player on here, Robert Altman's film. And a film, we really have to go back and look at this penalty box situation because I can't talk about Mulholland Drive anymore, so I'm putting it in the 6 through 10.
Okay, fair enough. Well, my 6 through 10, I have L.A. Confidential, and I just want to say the only reason it's not in the top 5, I do love the film, other than that it's probably been mentioned too much, is that it's not really about Hollywood as much as the others. I mean, it is obviously, it takes place there, and there is an aspect of making movies and that glamour and the seediness, but anyway, 6 through 10 for me. I also have Get Shorty, Barton Fink, Swimming with Sharks, and lastly,
I love it,
Team America World Police. Sam, a film you've been telling me to see for the longest time.
I was telling you it's better than South Park.
From the South Park guys, you're right. It's so much better than Bigger, Longer, and Uncut.
Yes, it is.
It is really brilliant. I'm so glad I saw it. And no, it isn't a movie about Hollywood in that it doesn't take place there like all the movies in my top five. But I just have to say that, of course, when you've got the Film Actors Guild, and it's all about those actors that take themselves too seriously trying to save the world. And, of course, the way it deconstructs Hollywood films. That's why it's on this list. You were right. The montage sequence, the whole song about how we need a montage is hilarious. And the way, really, I have to say, if you've not seen this film, go out and get it. I mean, be prepared for something crass and vulgar is the South Park guys. But it is brilliant because you've got a film that has puppets in it. That the whole film is puppets, but they've managed to actually basically replicate Top Gun and Pearl Harbor. They've made Top Gun and Pearl Harbor, but with puppets. Yep. All the shots are there. All the
and
moments are there.
You can't satirize something you don't know backwards and forwards.
Yeah, and they clearly love it and hate it at the same time. I mean,
I'm so lonely. Yeah.
It's brilliant. Okay, so anyway, that's my 6 through 10. Let's get into the top 5. Your number 5.
All right, my number 5, you disqualified it, but I am putting L.A. Confidential in here. And I think, again, I was thinking a lot of it about it in terms of what didn't work for me in Hollywoodland. And for me, you have a film that really does capture, for each of the characters, the sense of what the glamour of Hollywood, particularly Spacey's Jack Vincennes character. I mean, he really has to come to a crux here. It's like, follow the glamour or do what's right in his job as a police detective. And I think the movie, I love the movie anyway, and really captures that sense of, you know, the degradation of glamour. So I think it's very much about that time and captures that place.
Yeah, I love the film too. My number 5, probably not a big surprise that it's on here after our Screwball Comedies Marathon. It was my best picture. I've got Sullivan's Travels, Preston Sturges, 1941. You can listen to our full review on Film Spotting, number 119. Had a huge influence on the Coen Brothers, as we discussed, and also Woody Allen's Stardust Memories, and this great mixture of comedy and tragedy that you see throughout all of Woody's films, actually, or many of them. And the reason it's on the list, again, you can go back and listen to our full review of it, but this exchange alone merits being put on the list. I want this picture to be a document. I want to hold a mirror up to life. I want this to be a picture of dignity, a true canvas of the suffering of humanity, but with a little sex in it. But with a little sex in it. I mean, there it is in a nutshell right there, Hollywood. So I love it. My number 5.
Well, I'm going to take it as a segue. My number 4 is Sullivan's Travels. I think one of the glaring omissions when we go back to that movies about movies list, and neither of us had seen it at the time, it is absolutely brilliant, sophisticated, interesting film from Preston Sturges. And I won't talk any more about it.
Okay. Well, my number 4 is a film that's never come up, I don't think, on Film Spotting through 120-plus shows, and that is The Day of the Locust, a John Schlesinger film from 1975 based on the Nathaniel West novel. It stars William Atherton, who everyone will remember as the villain from Ghostbusters.
Oh, of course, right.
The bad guy from the EPA or whatever. And
isn't he the bad guy in Die Hard 2, the journalist?
He is, actually, journalist. Yes, that's it. He plays an art director out of Yale who comes out to Hollywood to make it big, has visions of grandeur, becoming a big star in Hollywood as this art director, making a living. It's in the 30s and, of course, gets disillusioned, as this is a Hollywood movie, a movie about Hollywood. He gets caught up with his neighbor, Faye, played by Karen Black, who wants to be an actress. And she's involved with an accountant played by Donald Sutherland, whose name is Homer Simpson. And I can't get a definitive ruling on this. Maybe some of our listeners know. But Donald Sutherland in the movie is even a little overweight. And doesn't have much hair. He's balding. He looks like Homer Simpson from The Simpsons. And again, I can't find definitively whether or not Matt Groening was definitively trying to say that this is inspired by The Day of the Locust.
But it can't not be, right?
It can't not be, is what I say. His name's Homer Simpson. The whole reason it's on here, though, the ending of this film, big, apocalyptic, kind of surprising, surreal almost ending to the film The Day of the Locust, as the name kind of implies, but a really interesting, depressing film. So,
All right, well, my number three, I mentioned it when we were talking about Hollywoodland, Sunset Boulevard, which I just saw for the first time. And, I mean, Norma Desmond, and again, I mean, this is a movie that just, you're so aware of it, you know, in terms of some of the lines and the character of Norma Desmond in popular culture. And she is an absolute monster, and I expected that, but she also represents this idea of past glory. She absolutely represents that idea in a way that you can, it shows a love for it. I mean, in terms of I think Wilder shows a respect for it in some way. She's not just a monster and not just represents the decay of that, but also, you know, reminds you of what people are doing there in some way. And there's enough sincerity in the way people treat her, especially Max, her first husband, but also her butler, Eric von Stroheim. You know, there's a true awe with which people hold her. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know. I was really just surprised by the film. The film is very cynical as well, but just the way it does absolutely capture it.
Yeah.
That feeling of glamour.
Yeah, it's there. My number three is a film that you left off or put in your 6 through 10. I couldn't relegate it to my 6 through 10. Maybe it's going into the penalty box. I'm certainly not going to say anything about it, but it is David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. I've talked too much about Naomi Watts' performance, but I do love the film. Again, out there, surreal, bizarre, hard to understand, hard to follow, better the second or third time around.
Yeah.
But something that's been a theme throughout all of your comments here, all I'll say, you know, absolutely capturing the wide-eyed wonder of coming to Hollywood, and then, as Lynch always does, completely subverting that and showing us the underbelly that's more bleak and dark and absurd than you could ever imagine.
And did you notice that in Hollywoodland, we have that shot of that really creepy character, like in the at the sort of hotel where Brody is shacked up, and there's that guy that's like that ancient
lifting
guy
weights.
Who's lifting weights, half naked,
feels
smoking
like
a cigarette. And it feels like a nod to Lynch, but you just, again, you wanted that movie to go further with that. If it's truly trying to capture the absurdity or the surreality of L.A., it's like that was its one little nod.
Right.
Another sort of idea it had that was left unfulfilled. Anyway, my number two, and again, my number one and number two did appear on that initial top five list, movies about movies. But number two, I do have Adaptation here. And you've just got this idea of somebody coming up against, like, do they want to sacrifice their integrity to keep their living going? I mean, Joe Gillis in Sunset Boulevard is facing that same dilemma. The quiet men and women that surround and feed the fire that is Hollywood in some sense. And I just love Kaufman's sort of self-deprecating look at the role of a screenwriter in Hollywood.
Okay. My number two, you already talked about it. It is Sunset Boulevard from Billy Wilder in 1950. We talked about the connections to Hollywoodland. And it also has a connection to Hollywoodland, though, in that it is very much about aging. And women dealing with aging, and as they get in, you know, older and into Hollywood, and how they get pushed to the side. Diane Lane's character—that's what it's all about. Much like Norma Desmond, where she shacks up with a younger guy so she can feel young, and that's really the only thing that gives her meaning.
Well, she has nine years left, or
seven years, I think. Yeah, and then you know, also that ties in with Hollywood growing, and as technology grows, things get cast aside. Things that were once relevant are no longer relevant. So.
It's a good pick. All right, my number one is Get Shorty, a favorite film of mine. In terms of a favorite film, I love to go back to. And shows this great awe, particularly the Chili Palmer character, played by John Travolta, has an absolute love and adoration for film. And that is absolutely contagious, but also has a really kind of gimlet eye for the characters that populate the place, the ridiculous nature, particularly Danny DeVito as Martin Weir, you know, the sort of pomposity of Gene Hackman's Harry Zim, these pretensions they all have for making the great next picture, even though he's a total B-lister, and everyone trying to redeem themselves, trying to find some redemption. Not only people in Hollywood trying to find artistic redemption, but you also have Chili Palmer trying to go legit, you know, trying some actual redemption, trying to find love, trying to find passion. Just top to bottom, hilarious film from somebody that knows but also loves Hollywood.
Yeah.
Not so cynical as some of these other pictures on our list.
A great choice, obviously, in my 6 through 10, a movie I like as well. And my number one is Bowfinger. No, I'm kidding.
Wow.
I'm kidding.
I didn't know what to do there.
I just wanted to throw you a curveball, Sam.
Just wanted to see if I was still listening.
It's not remotely close to making my list. But my number one is Singin' in the Rain, Stanley Donen, 1952.
Oh, nice.
Set in Hollywood in the late 1920s. Of course, you've got Gene Kelly, who we've already raved about during our musicals marathon, Donald O'Connor, who is amazing, Debbie Reynolds. And I had to watch this. I talked about with West Side Story, what was the top five list movies that we should have hated?
Oh, yes.
And I mentioned how West Side Story was a film I never wanted to watch until we forced ourselves to watch it during
That's right.
the musicals marathon, and I ended up loving it. Well, Singing in the Rain was the same thing. Yeah. I had to watch it in a class in college begrudgingly. Yeah. I just never thought I'd be into musicals. I don't know. I thought I was too manly for that or something, even though I like Grease. What is that?
I have no idea.
It was a childhood thing.
You're a walking contradiction.
I guess, but it was a childhood thing watching Grease, you know, a nostalgia thing. But almost immediately from the opening of Singing in the Rain, you're caught up in the energy of it, the wonder of it. And
it
really, in some way, this occurred to me, that a lot of these choices, and including Hollywoodland, these films are all about that dark side of Hollywood, that awe we've been talking about, but then in some way the darkness to it. This film doesn't really have that darkness at all. In some way, this is the film that redeems Hollywood completely.
That's interesting.
I mean, the town may suck, it may be hard, but look at what Hollywood can do.
They can
produce Singing in the Rain. They can make it makes all the bad stuff almost worth it, that they can make something as grand as Singing in the Rain.
Well, I think it's true. We both finished with films that are genuinely optimistic about Hollywood.
Yeah.
I mean, he goes to see, and just you see him absolutely love The Touch of Evil. You know, talks about Rio Bravo, and I mean, and I think it's nice to finish with an optimistic view. Hollywood does make magical things, and I'm glad we
occasionally
don't live
there. We don't have to crap on it all the time.
Right.
All right. Well, that is our top five. Please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. Or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message.
Opening this weekend, The Black Dahlia, The Last Kiss, The Rock in The Gridiron Gang, and the animated movie Everyone's Hero. We'll have a review of The Black Dahlia and possibly The Last Kiss
Or The Last Kiss and no Black Dahlia.
And maybe Everybody's Hero instead.
Both, actually.
Plus, top five most anticipated movies of the fall, we think.
We think. Again, this is kind of open-ended, but we had a listener suggest this, and I think it's not a bad idea. We did our most anticipated movies of the year, and some of them have yet to come out, including both of our number ones. But there are enough interesting films that we didn't know about back then that are on the radar that I'd love to bring people's attention to. Well, thanks to Dan Byrne and Messenger Records for today's music. Please check him out on the web at messengerrecords.com. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. Also on our blog, sign up for The Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Hallgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And by Smallville, the complete fifth season on DVD now. Own the incredible season when Clark faces rogue Kryptonians, Lex launches a vicious political campaign, and the Fortress of Solitude rises. Aquaman surfaces and other key elements of Superman lore fall into place. Smallville, the complete fifth season includes all 22 episodes, unaired scenes, commentaries, and the exclusive behind-the-scenes look at the making of the 100th episode. Own Smallville, the complete fifth season on DVD now.
Let's hear it for the boy. Come on, join in. It's Film Spotting. Sing along. Next.
Sing along time. And stop doing that.
This is by David Letterman. It's Film Spotting. Sing along time.
Do the whole thing again. I want to hear you sing again, Sam.
I don't know if I should this time.
Maybe just not as big and dramatic.
I wasn't going to. I was singing in church this morning, so I thought I might be warmed up.
Do it however it strikes you at the time, Sam.
When we come back, I can't do it. Can do it.